You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Well, we're going to do everything. Not just troll on in, we're going to dive right in and bring you up to speed on what's happening to the council. You know, as I told you early in the show, almost everybody either is in Samoa or was in Samoa. I didn't get to make the trip. I wanted to MC the forum, but it was another meeting. And one of the things getting into these meetings that we always talk about is the discussion of numbers, quantities, fishing habits, quotas, all of that stuff. And there's these studies that are done. And one of the reasons why we're glad today, Thomas Remington is with us. He's a fisheries analyst with the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. And he and his folks are tasked with finding out, getting data. And then at the end of the day, you want to find out where the data goes. That's kind of a long introduction to Thomas's this session of the program. But I do know that a lot of hands get busy in that stew, and a lot of what you were doing for the last year became valuable, and you've been using it in Samoa as tools. What is this meeting all about?
This meeting, I mean, it's about a lot of things for the people in American Samoa and, you know, the fisheries in the Western Pacific in general, but we've taken a position this meeting to kind of talk about data and the importance of data. And when we do these sort of what we call stock assessments, mm-hmm. we're learning how good are the fish doing? Is the fish population, is it healthy? Are there a lot of fish, et cetera? So we went down to American Samoa with this message that, you know, the data that goes into the assessment really mm-hmm. determines what comes out. So yeah. if we
now,
don't,
by the way, and when we're talking about pelagics and we're talking about bottom fish, we're talking about the entire fishery, right?
Oh, yeah, all sorts of fisheries because these sorts of assessments are done for pelagics, for bottom fish, for coral reef fish. So we were going to American Samoa talking about a bottom fish assessment first and foremost that recently came out. And it was showing that the bottom fish stock wasn't doing so well. Mm-hmm. But a lot of thoughts were about the data that went into the assessment. Was the data really representative of the fishing that was happening in American Samoa?
I love hearing that because, by the way, one of the reasons why you all are out there and why the council sponsors this part of our show is to show you the myriad of information that's available. All of the stuff that Thomas and I are talking about today is either up on or will be up on the website, wpcouncil.org. And it becomes very, very valuable. And it used to be thought of in the past, Thomas, and I know in the years that you've been there, you've heard this, that is, fishermen were very close to the vest about this information.
Right.
Because they thought it was going to negatively affect them.
Right. Well, there's a few reasons. People think it might negatively affect them if they're reporting that they catch
quantity,
this many fish. Then, you know, oh, that might be bad. They get a slap on the wrist. Or they might get restricted more. Or if they have a certain fishing hotspot they don't really want to share where they're fishing, they're getting all the good catch. That's understandable.
Yeah.
So there's a few different factors that are keeping people from kind of wanting to participate.
Mm-hmm.
But then the flip side is being able to participate and giving your information could ultimately help you as a fisher going
forward.
That's
the point I'm trying to make.
See, right.
I want to tell you, and I don't know, I've never shared this with you, but I have talked with Kitty and a lot of the other folks at the council over the years. Back in the day when I ran a commercial operation, we have these big books, the Fish Catch Report.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And back in the day, this is how old I am, it was carbon paper. So you'd have three sheets of carbon paper, and you'd have to bear down on the pen because you had to keep three copies, one for yourself, one to the council, and one to the state.
Right.
And almost everybody, whether they fished or not, would wait for months and months past when these were due, and then you have to do 4 months reports all at once. So you put no fishing.
Right.
And then when the quotas came out, they said, well, there's no fish. So we're not going to give these quotas because there's nobody catching these fish. So, but when they did the bottom fishing assessment a few years ago, it was the opposite, wasn't it? What a surprise. People go catch more fish.
Yeah. So that's the thing. So when people give their catch data, they're helping to inform those assessments of how the fish are doing. So if there's no catch data and there's not a lot of good information, then what the scientists are using as their truth for what's out there for the fish, it could be way off. So the more information you have, the more likely it is to be representative of the truth.
Okay,
right?
Now that being said, it's not just, and I think maybe you can explain a little bit about this, I've learned about it in the last couple of years, it's effort, it's a lot of other things, that it's not just strictly how many onaga did you bring back,
right know? It's about effort, and this is something a lot of people don't think about, and I find myself explaining. So I like to say this. So it's like, Imagine if you went out one day and you caught 10 fish, mm-hmm. and you went out the next day and you caught 10 fish. So they're pretty similar days,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, the first day you fished 1 hour, and the second day you fished 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now which day is better?
Yeah, you see, the first day was better.
The first day was way better if you fished 1 hour and you mm-hmm. caught 10 fish, and then the second day you had to fish 10 times as long to just catch the same amount.
Right.
So you're talking about extra fuel, extra time away mm-hmm. fishing, extra bait. So all those things add up, and they can be costs against the fisher.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think, if it's more efficient, that's something to think about too. So it's not just about, oh, I brought back 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how long did it take you to catch that?
Mm-hmm.
How many hooks did you set to catch that, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, you know, by the way, this really matters when we talk about the bigger end of the council, and that's the fleet and the longline fleet and everybody else. Because when you talk about effort, I don't think that the most of my listeners don't know this, Thomas, how much it costs to go longline fishing. In other words, when you pull out of the harbor, you're 30, 40 grand in the hole before you catch one fish.
Tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So it's almost an investment, right? You're saying, I bet that I'm going to be able to make this money back.
It's like going to Vegas.
Right, right.
Except you got hooks instead of dice.
You're gambling sometimes, right? Because you don't know. If you have a bad trip, you're coming back with nothing. And, you know, in some cases, there's been times when, you know, fisheries have closed in the middle of fishing trips for fishers, and they just have to stop and come back, and they lose
that
trip.
Well, that's a good example of that. And but by the way, those of you that are listening now, next week when the new Hawaii Boats and Yachts comes out, my column is dealing with this very thing that we're talking about, and that is the kind of fishing that you do determines, you know, the kind of quotas you're going to get. And one of the things that was always a big bother, and you can explain this, was what they call this interaction with the loggerhead and leatherback turtles.
Right.
And not killing them, just being in the same vicinity with them was going to shut the fishery down.
So they call it interactions. They don't. It's not necessarily that you're killing the turtles or that they, you know, they're dead on arrival, but just, you know, getting nearby or getting tangled in a hook or you know, something like, or tangled in a line, excuse me. They have to record that. And in the shallow set longline fishery in Hawaii, we have 100% observer coverage, which is amazing.
Every single boat, every single trip.
So when people talk about, people talk about the U.S. being the gold standard for fisheries management in the world, and some people scoff, but I point to this and go, you know, for our shallow set fishery in Hawaii, we have an observer on every single boat, making sure that everything is up and up.
What do people think? You just got back in Samoa about that feature that we have here that some of them don't.
Oh, I don't know if it's something that's highly considered. It's a foreign concept, really, to have someone on every commercial fishing trip, because it's a different concept. It's not such clear lines of this is a commercial trip, this is a recreational trip, this is a trip to
really
feed my
good
family.
I think in back in the day, Hawaii was like that too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
absolutely.
Some day was, you know, I'm hungry, so I better go get some fish to feed my family. Some days is I got to make a car payment, so I better go sell some fish.
Absolutely.
So my car.
There's this big cultural consideration in fisheries, even so. So like in American Samoa, culture is a big part of it, where people go fishing to gift fish to their chieftains or to their pastors. And, you know, it's hard to categorize that. They're not selling the fish. They're not, you know, keeping it for their family. So there's different ways to think about that, but it's just a big part of the culture as well. And you have to think about it not as terms of this industrial fishing fleet going out and kind of ravaging international waters, but, you know, the sort of culture that's doing so as they've done for thousands of years.
Have you noticed in that you're adding on the years at the council, that there seems to be, I don't want to say it's a paradigm shift necessarily, but certainly a shift in the trust issue, and that more and more fishermen are, usually because they're told by their peers, you need to do this. You know, I mean, otherwise there are consequences that may lead, you may not fish anymore.
I think it's been a slow burn for sure, but just with new technologies and things like that, new ways to show fishermen and share what the data are telling us and what they can do for us going forward, I think it's become easier to kind of get people to understand how their data input, how their participation might get a better product out. So for instance, we're in American Samoa showing some bottom fish fishermen the recent data trends. And this might have been the first time for some of them that they saw. Yeah, if they've ever been interviewed for their data, they get to see what their data does and what kind of trend it makes and how they're contributing to this kind of this whole fishery and the assessment of it.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And one of the things that Thomas and I were laughing about before we started to record the show is that, you know, when you do all of these studies, and we've spent a lot of time in the last year, some of you have been, you know, kind enough to keep listening and find out about these studies and how they're conducted. And I think that in addition to what you were explaining a little bit about effort, we can repeat that. Mm. But one of the other things is the actual technology that is spreading throughout the Pacific to be able to do this more accurately.
Absolutely. You know? Well, yeah, you were talking about your, you know, the big old logbooks that people used to have in the carbon copies.
Carbon paper, yeah.
And, you know, that's still a lot of people use that. Like, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But there has been a transition. Like I said, technology is getting kind of more and more widespread. Yeah. The council's supporting initiatives for electronic reporting and monitoring, so fishermen can...
You get a template, you go fill it in, click it away, boom.
You know? Easy. And so, you know, we've been conducting a lot of meetings with fishermen to kind of get their feedback and what they like and don't like and how they feel like they can give their information to us better or whatever makes them the most comfortable,
okay,
right?
When you're out in the field, and which you guys do a lot in collecting the data,
right?
I think that our listeners would be interested to know, okay, at the other end of that might be a bunch of data people that are not fishermen, and they don't want to be fishermen. They don't even eat fish, but they are tasked with and they have the ability to pour all of this information into a bucket and make it read.
Right, you know? Right. So that's another thing that people don't understand too. So once we get the data, it all goes into, let's say, a bucket, right? So then the scientists, some of these stock assessment scientists can look at the data and analyze it from there. So they're looking at that data. That's their baseline. That's their truth, right? So whatever they have as data, they have to assume that it's the best data they have to assume it's representative. So
yeah, I love that, you know.
I mean, that's just how science works. Until they have something better, that's the best thing they have to work with to say how a stock is doing, how are tuna doing, for instance.
We are, you know, in our business, we live and die by what we call ratings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you rate well, you get more money for your ads. If you don't rate well, you squirt some WD-40 on the wheels of your desk because you're out of here. You know what I mean? It really depends. But the other thing is that the level of sophistication that's been going into let's talk about the bottom fish assessment for a while. When you can put a camera down in the hotspot and have the camera record so much more than it ever used to be able to do.
And those things absolutely help the assessments because now you're not just getting fishing data, you're getting another source, a camera going down there and assessing and looking for a certain amount of time how much fish are down there. So that's another piece of data that can go in.
Are some of those practices being now used in down south or in like in Samoa and Guam and these places?
Mostly been done around Hawaii, but there are efforts, especially now that the assessments for bottom fish in American Samoa and Guam and Saipan have come out. I think there's going to be efforts to expand what we call life history research. And that's
Wait. I'm glad you said that because I was looking at some data the other day at wpcouncil.org.
Sure.
And I was surprised at the poundage that was being caught.
Oh.
You know, I mean, in Samoa, you know, and in other places, it's a lot. So that must mean that this science is going to justify looking at those numbers and making them, you know, so a guy can decide whether he's going to go invest in another boat or whether he's going to have his kid go to school and learn how to be a fisherman.
Right. I think these numbers can have extraordinary value to fishermen if they use them. And so something we've been trying to do at the council is make it easier because we know that looking at all these numbers and figuring out what's good and what's wrong is kind of...
Right. It can be overwhelming. Yeah, yeah.
Especially looking at... I mean, I almost did, and I'm the one coordinating these reports. They're just hundreds of pages long. So we've been trying to put together some online interactive portals so people can go on and sort of look at the data and more easily download it just so there's not as big of a barrier to kind of accessing this information, especially if you're a fisher that you're contributing or potentially contributing. So you want
to
know...
You know what I'm getting for some people? They're saying to me, hey, you know what? I'm glad I went to look at that website.
Good.
Because it was dormant for a while. Not dormant, but I mean, there wasn't a lot of activity. But now it is, you can more quickly surf it. And then more quickly use it. And I do know that it's not just fishermen. It's chefs. It's teachers. It's a lot of people that are looking at this data.
Yeah, it's just people that are just passionate about ocean and ocean sciences. Yeah. I know people look at it. And we've just revamped our whole website with the council. So if you go to wpcouncil.org, you'll be able to see the whole new website. It's really easy to navigate. Yeah. And then kind of nestled within that, you'll find our annual report portals, which you can just find at wpcouncildata.org as well.
And when you click that, it opens up some pretty interesting doors. And I even think that you must see it in the field where the fishermen and their families and some of the smaller markets, they're actually relieved because I do know that there's a lot of apprehension. Oh, they're coming down here. They're going to do a study. They're going to do this and that. Watch out, you know.
Yeah, it goes both ways, right? Because it depends on, I mean, I guess it ultimately depends on how we say the stock is doing, how the fish are doing. There's examples of a stock, you know, not doing so well, and, you know, having to kind of talk to the community about that and ways to rebuild. But then there's other examples of like coral reef stocks in Guam and CNMI that are doing just fine. And so, you know, those ACLs at the time could be pushed up so they could catch more.
Yeah, and that therein lies, all of a sudden that's a surprise and it's good news.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes you have to be the bearer of bad news, though. Let's talk about how sometimes it is really necessary to apply the data so that you can help help an area recover before it's too late.
Right. So, you know, remember, the data, whatever we have, is what, you know, the scientists are using as truth. And if it's reflecting a bad trend, you know, there's people are getting less efficient at catching. Oh, they used to be able to catch 10 fish in an hour. Now they're catching one fish in an hour. That's showing that there's not as many fish out there. Maybe they're not as big. You know, there's federal regulations that say fisheries managers have to do something about that. Mm-hmm. They have to, once they notice that something's going south, let's say, you know, there's obligation to step in and ensure that the fishery will be there for in the future.
You know, one of the things that was really neat, I was on one of the neighbor islands talking to one of the indigenous consultants so that we can do, you know, certain gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually relieved because Grandpa kept saying, there's always been fish here. And then Grandpa goes out fishing, doesn't catch any fish.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you can't just assume when you were in your 20s and you used to get 50 lobsters at that hole every year that they're going to be there again.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, another problem I like to kind of point out to people that they might not think about is something called shifting baselines.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Grandpa, he caught 50 fish there in that out of that hole every day. But then his son comes along, and the first day he goes fishing, he only catches 25.
Mm-hmm.
But to him, that's a good day.
Oh, yeah. Well, he just didn't have the skills that Grandpa had.
Well, he didn't have the skills, but he didn't, you know, he wasn't around long enough back to when a 50 was a good day. So for him, 25 is a good day. Now he has a son, and now 5 is a good day to his son.
Yeah.
And so we get the shifting perspectives of what's good and what's, you know, what's bad in terms of fishing. But it's like, if we really have that data, we can show how many fish there really used to be and say, why can't we get fishing back up to those good old days?
Exactly. You know, there's another thing, folks, that you got to consider, and that's fish don't know where exactly they are. So Grandpa's old fishing hole, they may be 100 yards away from there, you don't know, because that's not where you fish. But I do think that people still need to know, this is a massive undertaking. Somebody has to have a lot of patience to get all of this information together. So you actually presented, from what I understand, a number of these studies this year.
Yeah, there was a lot of studies that had to, that were presented, especially to the territories, because bottom fish assessments were done for each, you know, American Samoa, Guam, and CNMI, which is Saipan.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's about engaging with the community there and the fishers there so they understand where the assessment's coming from. They're not blindsided by a bad result, or, you know, they understand why a good result, or if it was sort of neutral. Just being able to break down the science, because it can be complicated, right?
Sure.
When you're looking at all these numbers.
Yeah, one thing, though, that I think that this would help somebody to understand a real benefit, and that is, let's say that they determine there's an awful lot of this particular kind of fish there, but they don't have a market. They, you know, they don't have a way to sell it or make any money from it, so they don't go catch it.
Right, right.
You know? And now all of a sudden, it may be worthwhile investing in talking to the restaurant in Honolulu from Samoa that you can get onaga 7 days a week.
Right, right.
So, it becomes opportunity attached to these studies.
Absolutely. It becomes an interesting intersection of, you know, economics and, you know, environmental considerations. You're thinking about which fish are more available and which fish might fetch a good price at the same time. So we have this thing called fisheries development.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of fish stocks out there that are doing pretty well, you know. Even in Hawaii, you hear a lot about like Mong Chong and Opa, and things like that. And pelagic fishes that aren't as popular as tuna. But, you know, you're starting to see them a bit more and more in the markets maybe. And I think that's a product of some, like I said, fisheries development. We're pushing the idea that these fish are also marketable. They taste good, and, you know.
Hey, by the way, you hit the button right on the button. A lot of people out there reacted to reports of lately the abundance of opa, and that used to be a fish that you caught by accident sometimes.
Right, bycatch.
Yeah, you know, and all of a sudden now it's targeted, and they're finding out that there's still a lot of big fish there.
Yeah,
that they have not significantly reduced the population. Maybe there's just not enough of them being caught, but it's encouraging that a whole almost subcategory of fish for the restaurants is available. It's great.
Exactly. And it's just, you know, sort of something to look into. Like, the fish hasn't been kind of explored in that way. You know, people are getting interested in terms of markets, so it might, the demand might be there going forward.
Let's also talk for a minute We talked briefly about how in other parts of the world, they're not as supervised or as watched as we are. Let's talk about the big revelation that just came out just the other day, and that is it's been determined by better science that the interactions with turtles are not as bad as they were thought to have been. As a matter of fact, we are pretty much guaranteed for the next 100 years at this rate of fishing that turtles are still
right.
safe. That's a pretty big deal.
From the new modeling assessment done from the Science Center, right, they were looking at the turtle takes done in the shallow set fishery that we were talking about in Hawaii. So this is the fishery that they're trying to catch swordfish.
Yeah, by the way, this is the Shitomi business. And you know, and it is incredibly important because we supply, I mean, it's about 95% of the swordfish.
Oh, a huge amount.
It's sold on the mainland, comes from Hawaii.
So yeah, a huge amount of the swordfish coming from Hawaii. And so we have a shallow set fishery. And, you know, it was in 2017, there's only 20 vessels fishing for those fish, right?
20. Right.
And I'm sure you've heard, and this is kind of what you're alluding to, there were closures of the fishery associated with interacting with too many turtles. So what happened, well, like I said before, they get tangled in the lines, they get on the hook, one thing or another. They don't necessarily have to die. They could be released alive.
As a matter of fact, the overwhelming number of them are released alive.
That is correct, actually. So like I said, and this is from 100% observer coverage. So we're getting the exact data exactly how it is. And so they've caught enough turtles to where they hit a limit. And the limit was kind of in flux because of some litigation. So a limit changed 2 or 3 times within the course of a year or two. So it was kind of variable in that way. And then they hit the limit, and the swordfish fishery has to close down. The shallow set, all those boats that are geared up for shallow set longlining, they have to come back to port, and they're done for the season.
You know, I got to tell you something really interesting. A lot of those boats come from the eastern seaboard. And what happened was these swordfish boats there back in the day were catching swordfish that averaged 400 pounds, 500 pounds. And they got so fished that they were down at 100 pounds and 75 pounds. And all of a sudden, a lot of these guys just determined that they couldn't make a living anymore.
Right.
And so they came to the Pacific, and we got overwhelmed with a huge number of boats. But it doesn't look as though, at least at this point, whether we're not worried about the size of the fish or the fishery yet, but we are concerned about the turtles that are in the same area with us. That gets
species.
Confusing to people.
It does, because they don't quite understand, like, well, how is this one thing so impactful to another? And it's looking at, so they're protected species, and everyone knows the Endangered Species Act. So there's regulations under that that say if a species is listed, then there has to be actions done to make sure that it's not put into jeopardy. So these loggerhead and leatherback turtles have been noticed as endangered species or threatened species in the past. So there's limits on how much you can interact or how many turtles you can come in contact with.
Yeah, what I thought was really cool a couple of weeks ago, lo and behold, right on the middle of a very popular beach, up come turtles.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and this is like a loggerhead went somewhere else and had a bunch of babies, and they became fascinating. And this actually swings data too, doesn't it, when they find out that, hey, wait a minute, maybe we just don't know that these animals are looking for a different place to give their birth. They're not going to where they used to
go. So like a lot of the turtle data is based on what we call nesters and nesting beaches. It's about the ones that are at a certain place laying eggs. But with things like climate change that are kind of changing ocean temperatures and climates throughout the globe, it's kind of causing species to shift a little bit more than they would. So like we look at where turtles usually are, or fish usually is, and there's not as many there. We don't know if that's because the stock is changing or if because the stock is moved due to different ocean conditions.
That's why it's interesting, gang. Thomas Remington is the fisheries analyst with the council, and we're talking about this today, and we've been talking about a lot of things. And with respect to that, I can tell you that I'm fascinated when we see these nesting grounds. I saw some video the other day, and the number of babies that are born and the numbers of babies that survive, it is like, thank goodness they're having a lot of them, because it must be, to go from a big round as a silver dollar to a couple hundred pounds is unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's their strategy, right? Yeah. So it's carpet bombing.
What were some of the interesting takeaways you've had? Well, next week, by the way, in the next couple of weeks, we're probably going to be talking to Josh DiMello and about the meetings. Thomas had to come back a little bit early to get some stuff done here, and that's why we were able to have him today. But I think that there are always some. Personally, what were some of the things that you found interesting this year?
I just loved the emphasis on data and getting, you know, more engagement with the communities so they know where their data is going, that it's not, you know, sort of Big Brother trying to bear down on them, you know, and the sort of whole idea of garbage in, garbage out. So it's the scientists helping the community help, you know, they're helping each other. All the scientists want to do is ensure a sustainable fishery. They're not trying to close down fishing forever. It's just to make
pretty
sure
simple.
That
it, do the thing, right?
So, you know, people can fish in the future, and there's ways to go about that that work for everybody. And it's just sort of about, it's about communication, and it's about understanding the fisher's perspective as well.
What can people, what can you share with us that shows where the information and all of these studies and compilations go? I mean, obviously, they were all compiled to get down there for the meeting. What are they used for? What are most of these studies used for?
Right. So like I said, so they're used for assessments, and they, what those do is they tell how healthy a fish stock is. If the group of fish is doing well, there's a lot of them, if they're big, et cetera, if they're easy to catch. And so when we do that, we're able to determine if fishers can catch more of a certain species or not. So,
do you see a sense of relief on some faces when you come out with that information?
Sometimes, you know, if it's more promising than people thought, you know, you can catch more big-eyed tuna. Yeah. That's good for everybody. But, you know, then you have the flip side where fisheries get a lower catch limit, or if they have to close down. And then you can see, like, some opposite things happening. So, like I told you before, the shallow set longline fishery in Hawaii, in 2017, they had 20 vessels catching swordfish. They got closed down. Yeah. The next year, they had 11 vessels.
Right.
So people aren't returning.
And therefore, the effort and the catch, everything's going to be skewed, because you're assuming that those 9 boats that didn't show back up had experienced crew and skippers on them that had the ability to catch a lot of fish, and they didn't go fishing.
Well, and even if you were to replace those boats, let's say a new boat enters the fishery, they don't have the same experience per se as that crew, so they might not be catching as efficiently. So there's so many, like you said, there's so many socioeconomic impacts that aren't always thought about right away
There's one thing that a lot of our listeners don't know, and that is they think that the swapping of the quotas and the extension of the ability for the Hawaii fleet to trade, to give to somebody else something to help their fishery in exchange for being able to catch the big eye in their waters. How'd that work?
So basically, it's based on the idea that, you know, like we've been talking about, there's a catch limit for Hawaii, how much they can catch for tuna. Now, the U.S. territories also in the Pacific Ocean around us, there's Guam, Saipan, and American Samoa, they also have limits for how much tuna they can catch. Their fishing fleets are much smaller, and they usually don't push up against those limits whatsoever.
And primarily distance. These are smaller boats. They don't have the same ability
to
travel. They really just don't have the ability to carry enough ice.
Yeah, and so they really don't have the same sort of longline fisheries like Hawaii does. And so basically, the thought is, given some science that has shown that the big eye and the different tuna stocks might be connected, you know, across the Pacific in different ways, that basically Hawaii is able to purchase a portion of that quota, the unused quota, use it for their longline fishers, and then the territories would get money for fisheries development.
And by the way, what I saw was unbelievable, because a lot of these small boats, these pongas, 26-footers, boat ramps not available, ice not available.
Right,
and all of a sudden, these people had no intention of going longline fishing.
Right.
But for their quota, they got something that they needed.
Right.
So what they're doing is they're feeding their families on their islands, not necessarily to grow a market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's the part that's fascinating.
Right. And still, their efforts and, you know, being able to make that swap is supporting their fisheries and being able to go out, like you said, you know, supplying ice machines and, you know, boating ramps and stuff
like
that.
Simple things, right?
Simple things will just enable access. And that's a big thing, is access.
What about the other side of it? And that is the difference between a lot of the boats that are fishing in the Pacific, these big boats, the mother boats, and they're snap freezing everything they catch, and it's totally different. And our fishery is a fresh fishery.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't the when you go down to Samoa, don't you get both there? You get the fresh fishery, which is day to day to day, the inside fish, and the outside fish, they do a lot of the freezing.
Oh yeah, so it's a crazy crazy game, because you know you have a lot of international fisheries as well that are transshipping through different countries, and you know some of these more massive fleets are out there for months at a time freezing, like you said, on these mother boats that are transshipping one or two times instead of just going back to port.
And you know, I do know that in Japan, they're feverishly working on trying to figure out how do you make sashimi out of frozen fish, and they're getting a lot closer in some areas, you know. But still, and I think that the parting gift that we always try to give the audience is that we are the most isolated part of the fishery, correct?
Yeah, we are. You know, I mean, Hawaii itself is one of the most isolated places in the world.
So when you take a look at the width and the breadth of the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council's area in geography, It's the biggest of all the districts.
Oh, absolutely. It's biggest in the nation by far.
So if we are, and we're sort of like the hub of it, right? We're in the
absolutely,
middle.
In Honolulu.
And as far away from everybody else as we can be.
Yeah, so it's hard. You know, that's why we have meetings. We have to go down there to American Samoa like the rest of my coworkers are. And
I bet they really appreciate it, Thomas. They really like you guys coming down there.
Well, I think it's good to do so because it shows that we're engaged. We're showing face. We want to be there. We want to be a part of the process. It's not some guy in an office 6 hours away that doesn't care.
But by the way, sometimes the decisions are made on quotas and limits and based on somebody that is in one of those offices. They're not in the field.
Oh, absolutely.
So your studies are what they use to make their decisions.
Right. So it's an interconnected process like that. Mm. So there's the studies and there's also the engagement with the community. It's, you know, that information necessarily will get passed into that data bucket, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so if communities have certain ways they want to do something, if they have information or things that they can pass into an assessment, that will also get considered. Mm-hmm. So like in that big bucket of like what we know beforehand, before we think about how a stock is doing.
Yeah, I think that's the other neat part, gang. And I wish we had enough time to really develop this. We'll try again in another show to explain what this effort is all about. So let's leave on that and what the effort is, because it used to be you came in with a bucket full of fish and you told somebody, I caught 41 of these, and they didn't ask you how long you'd been out, how far you'd been traveling, and now these studies aren't as valuable without that information.
Right, just knowing, you know, if you've been fishing 1 or 2 hours or, you know.
Yeah. What about travel time? I mean, let's say that I'm a longliner and I'm not going to fish within, I'm going to go 400 miles.
Right, absolutely.
Before I put any lines in the water.
That's been becoming a more important piece of information as we're tracking how far fishers have to go to get to their good fishing grounds, let's say, because it becomes a factor for economics, how much they're spending on fuel, a factor for safety at sea, if you have to travel much further. So it's something to consider as the fish stocks are changing and moving.
The other side of it, and I love this part of it, and you can explain it. It used to be, because of technology, it used to be these boats left, who know where they went or how long they stayed or what they caught or anything. You know, the boat leaves 20 days later, comes back with a bunch of fish.
Right.
We know within a few feet on the globe where all these boats are, don't we?
For the most part, we have this thing called VMS, which is Vessel Monitoring System. It's in the like council.
It's like a GPS on steroids.
Right. The Western Pacific Council has actually made headway on this in the 80s. We're one of the first bodies to kind of push this out. And it was just getting these commercial longline boats to have a system that will, you know, kind of generally say where in the globe you are. And that's good for identifying, you know, where you're fishing, but it's also for enforcement. You know, you know, if other boats are fishing where they're not supposed to be, you can kind of see that and, you know,
and it actually is a great way to document things. Anyway, what was the biggest takeaway? The meetings, I know it's a stress for everybody here. You guys all got to go down there. It's your foreign place and all that stuff.
Right.
Good one. Good meeting.
It's a good meeting so far. It's actually going on at this moment. Yeah. But from what the meetings that I was a part of, very constructive and, you know, hopeful for the future going forward.
You want to find out about these meetings and what come out of them, some of the reports, what you're going to do is go to WPCouncil.org. That's WPCouncil.org. Thomas Remy, thank you. We'll see you again.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
And if you want to hear something on the show, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Have a great weekend, everybody. And don't forget, WCouncil.org. Go look at some of these reports and see what they've been doing with all this time. Good stuff. See you next time.